Let's get back to How to Tour Italy on TalkZone.com. Once again, here's your host, Anthony Capozzoli.
Welcome back, everyone, and we have the great author, Angela Nickerson, who wrote a wonderful book called A Journey into Michelangelo's Rome, and I'm very excited to have her bail me out and give me the answer to that question, which I think I remembered, but I'm going to leave it up to her to save me, and with that, we'll welcome Miss Angela Nickerson.
Buongiorno.
Buongiorno. Come stai?
Very well. Thank
Good.
You. And you?
Wonderful. I don't know if you listened to the first segment or not, but I drew a blank in the middle of my Michelangelo discussion, which I was very proud of until that moment. And I think I know the name, and I'm just going to say it, and please tell me if I'm right or wrong. It's the Battle of Cascina.
Yes, exactly.
All right, good. So I'm not completely crazy. I swear I'm on a little bit of some cold medicine here, so I'm going to blame it on that.
That sounds good. No, that's actually a fairly obscure story.
Good stuff. And well, thank you very much for being a guest on the show. I'm very pleased to have you, and I'm sure that the listeners are going to be even more pleased with your insight on the wonderful art and history of Michelangelo.
Oh, certainly. I'm happy to be here.
Well, great stuff. Why don't you tell us a little bit about your book, and we'll get started from there.
Well, it's actually it's kind of a hybrid book. It is part biography of Michelangelo and then part guidebook to Rome. The whole idea is that if you have never been to Rome before, or you have been but you're looking for a different kind of theme for your trip, this is the way to go. There are maps. There are lots of photographs. It's organized chronologically. There are no hotels or restaurant reviews or anything like that. But it is simply about the places in Rome that were most important to Michelangelo and most important in his life.
Oh, that's wonderful. That sounds great. And I did have a look at the book and thought it was absolutely wonderful. I very well put together. The images are great, the maps, and as you say, the itinerary and stuff. So very well done. And I think that anyone visiting Rome, whether it's your first or 20th time, I think would benefit very, very much from buying your book and reading through it. And what I thought was kind of cool about the book, you can either read it before on the way over on the plane or something, or just, you know, keep it in hand as you're walking through and use it as a kind of a learning aid, if you will, as you're enjoying the wonderful work from Michelangelo.
Absolutely. And that's actually how that's how it was designed. My whole goal is that I often see travelers wandering around Rome looking very overwhelmed. And it's easy for that to happen. You have a city with thousands of years of history, much of which is visible in different places, and not having a context to put all of those things in, I think can be a little shocking sometimes. I have stood, for example, in the Piazza San Pietro and listened to people who are talking about just absolutely being exhausted by
sure.
the city. And being surprised, I think sometimes first-time travelers imagine Rome to be a little bit like Disneyland, where
well put.
It's not actually a functioning city. But the thing is, Rome, of course, is a huge city. And
oh, yeah.
there are people, you know, doing their business and taking care of everything else, and the ruins are right in the middle of it. So I think one of the things that can help travelers, whether they've been there before or this is their first trip, is to have a framework for their trip. And that's part of why I think Michelangelo makes a fantastic framework for that, because the ancient ruins were very important to him as a humanist. He knew the history of ancient Rome and he knew the stories. And so you get both an introduction to ancient Rome and the Roman Empire, but you also see the glories of Renaissance Rome.
Sure.
And many of the churches that Michelangelo's work is in, and some of the other places that I talk about in the book, also have beautiful examples of Baroque Rome and even modern Rome. The Ara Pacis, for example, is a great and controversial architectural example that was just opened a couple of years ago. So,
yeah, I think you raise a great point. And one of the things, especially following kind of the path of Michelangelo, as you lay out so beautifully in your book, as you mentioned, you will stumble across and embrace lots of other wonderful things about Rome and the museums and the buildings and the piazzas that might go unnoticed. I know One of the things I always tell people when they ask me, you know, where can I go see Michelangelo? I've only got one day in Rome. And that's always a tough question to answer, I think, because one day in Rome is not nearly enough. However, if they don't have time because they've got some other things to do and they're not going to get to the Vatican, which is a real shame, one of the places I point them out are, well, three, I should say. The Piazza Campidoglio, because they can get a taste of Michelangelo's architecture, which I think is wonderful.
Absolutely.
And I think Santa Maria Sopra Minerva, which is St. Mary, above Minerva, obviously. And you can see the risen Christ, which is usually not a crowded visit. It's, what is it, 40 steps away from the Pantheon, and you get a taste of Michelangelo's handiwork, albeit a bit touched up because I believe they put a loincloth over Jesus. He was originally nude. But you get a real sense of his handiwork, and you can enjoy it for hours without being interrupted, which is something that I think, as far as Michelangelo goes, is unique.
Absolutely, and it's so unusual. I mean, I don't think I've ever been to Santa Maria Sopra Minerva, and I go there. It is always my second stop when I arrive in Rome. The first stop is the Pantheon. The second stop is Santa Maria Sopra Minerva. But I've never been there with a crowd. Never.
Yeah.
And have spent a lot of time just sitting and admiring. And the other part about that, about the risen Christ that's so magical, is that you can get very close to see it, which is also unusual with Michelangelo's work. Generally, it is, you're kept at arm's length, or in the case of the Sistine Chapel, you know, it's very far up there.
Indeed.
But with the risen Christ, you can actually see the chisel marks. You can get very close to it. Clearly, don't touch it.
Right.
though I will tell you, the foot of Christ is worn down and started to wear away. In fact, at different points in history, there's been a bronze slipper put on the foot. Because the faithful would come and touch the foot for good luck or for a blessing or something. And so it has been worn away over the centuries. So clearly this was a sculpture that was intended to be an object of devotion. And one of Michelangelo's contemporaries wrote about the sculpture and talked about how the knees made him weep.
Really?
Yeah.
Well, tell us a little bit about that. That's fascinating to me. I love that kind of stuff, like the side notes. That's the kind of stuff that I like to dig into.
Oh, absolutely. Well, in fact, this was a commission done for that particular church. And there is some speculation, particularly by an American scholar named William Wallace, who teaches at Washington University in St. Louis. He has done a lot of research into this particular sculpture, and his theory is that the placement of it in the church is incorrect. There are a lot of critics who say, oh, this is Michelangelo's worst sculpture. There are things about the Christ that are out of proportion and that kind of thing. Well, Wallace has done a lot of kind of light studies on the sculpture. And, of course, Michelangelo was a master of understanding the way light worked with stone, but also in architecture. And so given that the sculpture was designed for the building that it is still in, and he's done light studies on the building itself and where the light would have come in, his postulation is that the sculpture was actually designed to sit in a niche that would have been in the wall somewhere, probably in one of the side chapels. And there is one sketch done by someone, I think about 100 years after Michelangelo's death, that seems to indicate that it was actually in a niche. Now, if that's the case, the niche then would have created shadows. And Christ would have been emerging from those shadows as if he was emerging from the tomb. And the way the light would have fallen on Jesus and the way that the figure would have had light and shadows, his nudity would not have been an issue because there would have been a shadow that would have fallen across the genitals that are there. And your eye would have been directed in different ways so that the proportions would have been absolutely accurate. And I think that's a fascinating idea that the figure has been moved to the front of the church. It's very brightly lit, and suddenly it doesn't look as good as it possibly did when it was displayed in the corner, in the shadows, emerging from the dark into the light.
And that makes perfect sense, being the topic, risen Christ. I mean, that would make perfect sense coming, I don't know if Jesus would ever be considered being in the dark, but certainly, metaphorically speaking, from the dark into the light, in the use of light to bring him to, I guess you would say, transfigured into Christ himself. So that makes perfect sense to me. And knowing what I know about Michelangelo, and I am no expert, however, I do find him to be one of the more fascinating artists, not only through your book. I read another book called The Agony and the Ecstasy by Irvin Stone.
Mm-hmm.
And I thought it was a really good book. I mean, it's historical fiction, and they do a very good job of kind of guiding you through the life of Michelangelo, through his struggles, which are truly the agony and the ecstasy. And knowing what I do know, it seems odd to me that he would create anything that wouldn't fit perfectly into where it should have been or in situ. So that's a good theory, and I'm glad that somebody's able to prove it, because that makes sense to me.
Yeah, and I think you're exactly right. He really designed. He designed for whatever space a particular piece was going to be displayed in. The Pietà in the Vatican is another example. That, of course, was designed for the old St. Peter's, which has been destroyed and replaced by the new St. Peter's. It was also designed to be on the floor and to be a tomb marker. So it would have been something that people could get much closer to. Of course, after the terrorist attacks in the 70s on it, it's now behind bulletproof glass, and you can't get very close to it at all. But
which is sad.
I'm sorry?
Which is very sad, I think. I mean, it's one of the world's finest sculptures, and the fact that it's behind the bulletproof glass and you've got to take pain to get close to it is a real sad thing. But please continue. I'm sorry to interrupt.
Oh, no, that's fine. This is another example. There is a very faint line across Mary's forehead, which, given the lighting that we kind of assume would have been the case, in old St. Peter's, light that would have come from the clerestory windows at the top and come down on her, it would have cast a shadow across her face as if she was wearing a veil, and directed your attention not on her, which is really what you see now because it's up above and you can look at her face, but on the body that's laying in her lap instead. And so, you know, I think Michelangelo, he was a genius when it came to knowing what light and shadow could do to his own work.
Yeah, and he did wonderful things. I mean, the Pietà, as you mentioned, I love the drapery work. I mean, that might be one of the things that people maybe overlook, but the drapery under Jesus, which comes from the dress of the Virgin Mary, is one of my favorite pieces of that work. And the fact that it's a single block of marble, and that story I mentioned about Michelangelo sneaking in to St. Peter's to sculpt, you know, Michelangelo the Florentine was making, is a great story, and I love it. And I think another good story, if we can get into that, we got about maybe 4.5 minutes here, is about the tomb of Julius II and the great statue of Moses. And I think the story behind it, I mean, the statue of Moses is absolutely stunning. I think just the veins in his arm make it truly amazing. And then the fact that it was an unfinished work in terms of its placement in the tomb of Julius II, and how Julius would probably be annoyed knowing what the tomb turned out to be like as opposed to what it was supposed to be, is wonderful. And that might even be one of those works, too, that you have to take a little bit of effort to get to the specific church where you can enjoy the work. And it, depending on the time of day, I've been in there where there's been one or two people and been in there with hundreds. So I guess it's kind of a crapshoot, but you know, I just thought it'd be nice to point those out. And I guess I have one quick question.
Sure.
What is your least favorite Michelangelo work? I know that puts you on the spot. Everyone probably asks you what your favorite is. I'm always curious to know what people's least favorite from Michelangelo would be.
You know, I am not... The Medici tomb in Florence, at San Lorenzo.
Yeah.
That's probably my least favorite, not because I don't think they're well executed, because I think the women are not as graceful as many of the women in his other sculptures. And there's something about them that feels very kind of hard to me. You have figures of dawn and dusk and that kind of thing.
Sure.
And they don't, he was a very sensitive painter and sculptor, especially of women. And I postulate that this had to do with the fact that his mother died when he was six. And I think, given what I know about Italian men and how they feel about their mothers, I think that that was something that really transformed him.
Yeah.
And there is this wonderful softness. The women in the Sistine Chapel, for example, the mothers and the children who are together in the scenes along the sides, they are so sensitive and tender. And the Medici tombs, I think, if I can at all say this about Michelangelo, fall a little short.
Yeah, you know, it's funny because that is the that's exactly the work I was thinking of, and I agree with you on the creation of the women. I think it's his, misrepresentation of the female form, if I can even say that about him. I'm not making any judgment, but I agree with you on that. And I also think the chapel itself, I don't know if it's the light, or I always feel so distant to the work. It doesn't seem to come together like any of his other wonderful sculptures and paintings, and I think that the emotion I get out of it seems too sad for me or something. The other ones, even though most of the depiction is of, you know, whether it be Genesis or the Pietà or his other Pietà, I mean, some of those topics are sad, but for some reason that seems unattached to me. I don't know why.
Yeah, I agree. There's a distance there, and perhaps that's what he was aiming for.
It could be, because he probably didn't like the, you know, the Medici family. I mean, I know he probably had his fallings out with them and being forced to do much of the work, and he probably said, you know, fine, I'll do it, but I'm going to make it be a little bit more emotionless for you or something. I don't know.
Well, we also have to think about the Renaissance sensibility and their sense of both death and, you know, where the Medici family fit in politically. And he may have been going for a much more distant feel than we, as, you know, 21st century observers are interested in. So
sure.
It's hard to say.
I agree. What I wanted to say, though, actually, I'm sorry to wrap. I'd love to have you on again and continue this wonderful discussion, but I thought it's important for the listeners to know, where can they find your book and get access to not only your book, but your wonderful blog and your walking tours that you provide, or your guided visits to Italy?
Absolutely. My book is available at all major bookstores and online, Amazon and the like. And you can find me on my website, which is www.michelangelositaly.com. That's where you can find out information about upcoming tours. I have one that is going to go at the end of April, and there are still places available on that. And then my blog is aknickerson.blogspot.com. And so you're welcome to join me there. And, in fact, I am writing this week about a surprise wedding that I was that I helped arrange for some travelers who went with me a couple of years ago. So
surprise wedding in Italy, that's got to be quite a bit of work, I would assume.
It was really fun, though.
Well, good stuff. And I'll tell you what, everyone out there, you can find links to everything that the wonderful author and guided tour of Angela on my website, unabellavista.com/radio show, and I'll put links up there so that everyone can access you and buy your wonderful book. Well, Angela, thank you so very much for being a guest on the show, and I'm looking forward to speaking with you very, very soon.
Thank you so much.
You're welcome. Ciao.
Ciao.
If you love travel, imagine visiting one of the world's greatest cities and exploring it as very few ever have. Only Context Travel makes it possible. Context Travel offers in-depth walking seminars for intellectually curious travelers like you. It's your chance to experience a city as a cultural experience unlike any traditional tour. Context Travel is a network of architects, historians, and art historians. They feature small groups of six or less, led by PhD-level scholars, with walks lasting from 3 hours to a full day. You can book a Context tour in 7 great cities: New York, Paris, London, Rome, Florence, Venice, Naples, or Istanbul. Context Travel offers concierge services, art and archaeology walks, cuisine walks, shopping walks, and more. Visit us online at contexttravel.com. That's contexttravel.com. That's contexttravel.com.